Good afternoon, and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. You can find us online at commonwealthclub.org. I'm Christina Namath, Travel Director at the Commonwealth Club. It is my distinct pleasure to welcome our speaker today. Charles Frankel is the Honorary Consul for the Republic of Botswana. He was first appointed in 1981 after serving as Botswana Country Director for the Peace Corps from 1973 to 1975. He is also the Honorary Vice Dean of the San Francisco Consular Corps. Consul Frankel has extensive experience as an entrepreneur and a manager in private, public, and nonprofit enterprises, as well as in community development. He currently is a principal in Interim Museum Services, which provides interim directors to museums. He has served as officer or director of many nonprofit organizations in international affairs and development, art, social services, education, music, and health. He has been president of the International Development Conference and a vice president of the Society for International Development in San Francisco. He served as chair of the board of the Smithsonian National Museum of African Art and was a board member of the National Peace Corps Association. He currently serves on boards of both of the World Affairs Council of Northern California and the Goldman School of Public Policy at the University of California, and is a member of the Pacific Council for International Policy. Please join me in welcoming Charles Frankel.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you very much, Christina. Can you hear me all right? Great. And now you know more about me than you probably wanted to know or need to know. And I'm going to do the same thing about Botswana. I tell you a little bit more than you want to know or need to know in the next 30 minutes or so. But I'm going to start off by just saying that I'm delighted that there are a number of members of the Commonwealth Club who are heading for Botswana, and I hope that if they are here, this will embellish the trip for them, and I hope that it will cause many of you to want to go to Botswana as a result of getting some insight into the history and the politics, the economy of the country. So I hope you'll think about traveling to Botswana in the future. And I'm going to start out by trying to put Botswana in the context of Africa very rapidly, because I'm sure most of you are familiar with the continent, and you know that it is comprised of about 53 countries, and it's 2.5 times the size of the United States. Botswana, of course, is located down in the very bottom. Let's see if I can get this to operate. Well, is it there? There it is. Ah, thank you very much. So Botswana is right there. And it's in the south, and in what the people in Botswana would say sometimes a dangerous neighborhood. Let's see if we can move to the next one. This gives you a little bit better idea. The population of the total continent is about 1 billion people. And Botswana is a very large country, but with a very small population. It's a country the size of France, so it's not that small. This country the size of Texas, so it's not that small. And a significant part of the country, as I think you all know, is made up of the Kalahari Desert, 70% of the country, in fact. Now, that is not quite like the Mojave Desert or the Sahara Desert. It's a desert where there is a lot of life, and so you can't write it off. But the interesting part about the country is that historically, the population has always lived in this corridor, That's running down from Zimbabwe to South Africa, and there's a railway line in that area. Whereas the resources of the country have always been up in the north. The water comes in from Angola and creates the Okavango Delta, which is really the major water source in the entire country. So it's been very difficult to support an increasing population as it increasingly concentrates along the southeast side of the country. The Okavango Delta is a beautiful area which not only is a source of water, but where much of the wildlife of Botswana lives, and it's a major tourist destination. So let me take you back to the Botswana Protectorate. That's really where modern history started. And in 1885, Botswana land was created when a group from Botswana, from then Botswana land, went to Great Britain and asked to be put under a protectorate. There are a number of different versions of this. Sometimes people in Botswana, perhaps correctly, say that the British were a little bit more aggressive than that. But in fact, it was never a colony per se, and that had both advantages and disadvantages. But these were some of the people who were running the country at the time. They were the chiefs of Botswana. What Botswana was concerned about was that there was a lot of pressure from South Africa to take over the country, from Cecil Rhodes, who was moving up to what became Rhodesia. And so they wanted to avoid that. The British ultimately created a capital of the country in an area south of Botswana, which in fact was in South Africa, and it was a place called Mafeking. So there was never a capital of Botswana land in the country. And in the 1950s, the paramount chief of the largest tribe, the Bamangwato tribe, a man named Seretse Khama, went to Oxford to study. And as a result of that, he met a woman whom he ultimately married, named Ruth Khama. And that resulted in, he married her in 1948, and that upset the world. The South Africans, who were just moving into apartheid at the time, were very upset with this union. And Winston Churchill decreed that he should be exiled from that area and remain in London. This is the paramount chief Seretse Khama and his wife. In 1956, however, he returned to Botswana finally, of a bid by various chieftains from Botswana land to let him return. And over a period of the next 7 years, he became again the paramount chief of the Bamangwato. And in 1966, Botswana achieved its independence. This was following many of the other countries of Africa, which in the early 60s were able to shake off colonialism, either peacefully or not. But in Botswana's case, it was peaceful and it was well planned. They determined where the new capital should be, in a place called Gaborone, fairly close to Mafeking, across the border from South Africa. And Botswana at that time had a population of about 600,000 people. Its new capital, Habaroni, started out with close to 20,000 people by 1966, and they had a per capita income in the country of $80 a year. Botswana, as it became independent, was one of the least developed countries in the world, according to the United Nations. They had 8 miles of paved roads. They had no government schools or hospitals, although they had 3 private secondary schools. There were under 10 college graduates who were citizens of the country. So it was resource poor in terms of education, and they were starting from ground zero for sure. At that point, the economy was dependent on beef exports, and they were having major problems with hoof and mouth disease. The main income source of the country was remittances from citizens of Botswana who were male miners in South Africa. Botswana at that time was said to have more cattle than people, and I suspect that that's true. The cattle traditionally are a sign of wealth. They are not a source of income. And Botswana generally collect cattle, they don't sell them. That's changed in recent years, but it was certainly the indication of wealth at the time of independence. Botswana created a flag, a national anthem, and a constitution. As you see, their flag is a blue field, which is emblematic of the water in the sky, water being so important to Botswana in the blue sky, which dominates the country. And black and white were chosen as the middle bands to indicate that Botswana would be a multiracial democracy, which it became and still remains. Early surveys predicted that Botswana would require external budget support forever. Seretse Khama became president, and in the capital they built a dam to provide drinking water and water for industry in the capital. It became, as I mentioned, a multi-party democracy, but pretty much dominated at that time and still by the Botswana Democratic Party, which was the party of Sir Seretse Khama. Khama chose as his vice president another Oxford graduate named Kwet Masiri, who subsequently followed Seretse Khama when he died as president. There is a long tradition in Botswana of conferring to make decisions and making decisions more or less by consensus. And that's done in what's called a khotla. In every village, people get together to make these decisions, but more importantly, to discuss issues. And that continues to today, where in every village, people get together, both men and women, young and old. Botswana created not only the presidency, but a legislature with two houses, a National Assembly and a House of Chiefs. The House of Chiefs discusses and debates, but has no veto power. And there's also an independent judiciary. So let's fast forward about 46 years to 2012, because I know you're interested in what's Botswana like today. Sir Seretse Khama encouraged mineral exploration, and the result was that in the early 70s, there were discoveries of diamonds, copper, nickel, soda ash, coal, cobalt, and the most important, of course, was diamonds. In the case of diamonds, Botswana wisely made a joint venture with De Beers from South Africa, a 50-50 agreement, so that De Beers' knowledge and experience, both in mining and marketing, would play a major role, and it has played such a role in the last 46 years. Botswana has several significant diamond deposits, and they've been discovered serially as the years have gone on. Zwaneng is the world's largest and richest diamond mine. Another is Orapa, which is an open pit mine, and I think this gives you some indication of what it's like. It's very large, and some of you who are familiar with movies about blood diamonds will really see a significant difference. This is a large commercial mine in a town that was created around the mine, which is completely fenced off from the rest of the country, accessed only by passes, and you have to go through all kinds of machines and checks to get in or out, and you don't want to bend down to pick anything up while you're inside this area because you will be seen on a video monitor and examined before you leave. The machines that do the business in this mining area are absolutely huge. As you can see, they dwarf a human being. This is a conveyor and sorting tower in the Orapa area. Botswana is the largest producer of diamonds in the world by value. It produces 29% of the world's diamonds compared to Russia, 19%, and South Africa, 15%. And Botswana is also second in volume in diamond production. It produces 30 million carats a year. It's a lot of diamonds. 85% of Botswana's foreign exchange comes from diamonds. 65% of its government support comes from diamonds. A third of its GDP comes from diamonds. So that gives you some indication of its importance. Gaborone, the capital, is now a thriving city where it was 20,000 at the time of its creation, 1966. It now has 200,000 people living there. And with that has come, as you can imagine, all kinds of issues, like the dam that was built for a population of 20,000 has had great difficulty. It's been expanded several times, but water remains major issue. These are the ministry buildings that were built in the 1960s and 70s, and behind it a tall building which is the headquarters of Debswana, the diamond company. The town, however, is not limited to one such building. There are many buildings around town today which are not only tall, but I think architecturally quite interesting. Residents of Gaborone today live in houses, much as we do here in the United States, and apartment buildings as well, and they shop in shopping malls, not unlike some suburban malls that we have here in the United States, for better or worse. In terms of economic growth, Botswana averaged about 9% per year between 1966 and 1997, a 30-year run at 9%. It was at that point for all those years the fastest growing economy in the world. And after that, about 6% for the next decade. And during that time, per capita income has increased from $80 per capita in 1966 to over $13,000 per capita today. Tourism has become second only to minerals as an income producer, with over 300 lodges and tented camps in the game parks of Botswana. 20% of the country is set aside as game preserve. And places like the Okavango Delta, which you saw earlier, Marami and Chobe and the Kalahari, they're all national parks where tourists are welcome today. They're premier destinations for safaris in all of Africa. The tented camps are luxurious and comfortable, and the animals and birds are plentiful and accessible. I mentioned that there had been 8 miles of roads at the time of independence. That's been transformed into 4,000 miles of paved roads in Botswana today, more roads per capita than any other country in the world. Agriculture constituted 40% of the GDP in the 1960s, and now it is less than 3%. That's both a sign of increased industrialization and diamonds, obviously, and also decreased agriculture activity. Cattle raising, once the main source of funds, is now third most important in the GDP after minerals and tourism. There's been a steady reduction of poverty, according to the World Bank, from 59% in 1986 to 23% currently. Botswana has consistently been ranked as the least corrupt country in Africa. It's 32nd in the world, and it's less corrupt than 9 EU countries, according to Transparency International. Well, that probably won't surprise you. The World Economic Forum rates Botswana as one of the two most economically competitive nations in Africa, ahead of South Africa, Mauritius, Gambia, and Tunisia. There are 9 free years of education and 300 secondary schools in Botswana, and you'll recall there were no government secondary schools at the time of independence, and only three private schools. Enrollment in the last decade alone doubled in secondary schools from 100,000 to well over 200,000. And there's an over 85% literacy rate in the country. The University of Botswana, created in the early 1970s, today has a student population of over 10,000. There are many vocational training schools, 6 technical colleges, excuse me, and there are over 35,000 Botswana who are in tertiary education and training institutions. Botswana International University of Science and Technology, called BIUST, has just been established. They have just completed their structure north of Habaroni, about 2 hours, and they are going to welcome their first class, in the next several months. In terms of health, Botswana has one of the best networks of clinics and hospitals in all of Africa. I think you, however, are all aware that Botswana has also been devastated by HIV/AIDS over the years, At one point, at its peak, it was about 40% of the population. Today, it's down around 20%, but still a significant issue. It's been a huge cost of treatment and prevention, diverting funds from a variety of other priorities, and it's had an adverse effect on both productivity and anticipated life. The former president who left a few years ago, President Mochai, introduced a requirement that anyone visiting a health facility is required to be tested for HIV. And he started off by having himself tested publicly when he announced this. Governance, as I mentioned earlier, started and remains. It's a multi-party democracy. Elections have been held every 5 years. And there is now a two-term or 10-year limit. The fifth president is the son of the first president. I guess we're familiar with that issue in the United States ourselves. But President Ian Khama became president in 2009. He had been appointed as vice president under President Mochai, and when President Mochai reached his 10 years in office and left office, Ian Khama became president. There was just a Gallup poll that was released a few weeks ago, a poll that took place in October. And apparently the administration of Botswana is rejoicing in the fact that Ian Khama has an 81% approval rating, which is not bad, especially if we look at our president, I guess. It's the highest approval rating, for what it's worth, of any president in Africa, probably anywhere else in the world as well. In terms of political stability, the World Bank Institute rates Botswana as first in Africa, 16th in the world, and it's above all of the G8 nations. There's a vigorous, independent, and critical press. There are mass circulation Sunday newspapers, half a dozen private daily newspapers, and three private radio stations and private TV station. The mobile phone penetration exceeds 100%. Botswana, I just wanted to give you a current update on what it's like today. Even on a micro basis, Botswana has made major efforts to diversify its economy. Obviously, it has been dependent on diamonds, and that can't last forever. I know they say diamonds are forever, but it's not so for a country. It's a limited time resource. Botswana is very aware of it. So it's created several hubs to focus attention on areas that Botswana feels have potential for the future. They've created hubs in innovation, education, health, transportation, agriculture, and diamonds. And in the diamond area, they've established a new way of adding value to their diamond production by cutting and polishing the stones in Botswana. They now have permission to do that, and that will make a big difference. And they're about to create jewelry for the international market in Botswana as well. Debswana is in the process of moving its London-based international sorting and marketing operations entirely to Gaborone by the end of next year, 2013. And then beginning in 2014 or earlier, 10% of the diamonds produced in Botswana will be sold there, resulting in diamond traders from around the world coming to Botswana to do business several times a year. As De Beers' chairman stated, quote, "The diamond industry's center of gravity is shifting. It'll add about $5 billion to Botswana's GDP, which is not bad." The innovation hub, on the other hand, just to look at a couple of the other areas, the innovation hub which has just completed the construction of this new headquarters. 270,000 square foot physical presence in Botswana is in the process of seeking tenants. They want to turn the country around so that it will be a knowledge-based economy. They're attracting tenants involved in clean technologies such as solar and wind, biotech, and information technology. Some years ago, Botswana established the International Financial Services Center, a world-class financial services hub to develop cross-border financial and business services within Africa. It provides a variety of tax incentives and facilities, and several firms from around the world have taken advantage of it, including Aon Risk Solutions, which is a subsidiary of an American company. The Open Skies Initiative is a program that the government is involved in at the moment. It's actively seeking to attract international airline companies who will fly directly from Europe, Asia, and the U.S. to Gaborone, decreasing dependence of Botswana on the Johannesburg Gateway and making Gaborone into an air cargo hub. They are also studying freight rail routes through Namibia and Mozambique in order to provide improved and diverse access to shipping routes, which are so important for a landlocked country like Botswana. I thought it might be interesting to finally introduce you to, as I end my comments, some unusual aspects of contemporary Botswana. For example, it was really only a few years ago, 4 or 5 years ago, that Botswana entered its first Miss Universe contest. And Miss Botswana won and became Miss Universe. So Mpule Kwelahobi, who had worked for a Harvard AIDS program, and after she became Miss Universe, she became a goodwill ambassador for the UN Population Fund. Something that really surprised me, and I go to Botswana every year or two, is that Botswana, moving from the sublime to the ridiculous, has a very large subculture of heavy metal music in the country, and the audience dresses in what I gather is appropriate dress, having had no experience myself. Have to take their word for it. And then motocross racing has taken place in Botswana for the past 20-plus years. There are tracks in half a dozen towns around the country. And just a week ago, 1 week ago, a 10-year-old Botswana, Brady Armstrong, won a major motocross race at the Sacramento, California Raceway. Hard to believe. So, I think finally one more little tidbit for you. One of the most likely winners of the Summer Olympics games in London in the 400-meter race is a Botswana, whoops, don't have her picture here, but is a Botswana. She's a 26-year-old. She's already won in the Commonwealth Games and the All-Africa Games, and her name is Amantle Monzo. So Botswana is really focusing on her as their bet to win the Olympics. We have taken a voyage through history over the last 125 years of Botswana. And since independence, I think it's done, perhaps not objectively, but I think it's done amazingly well. Its governance has been outstanding, and so has its economy and its human development. It certainly has problems, and it's trying to deal with those problems and challenges. But it stands out today as a model in Africa. I hope that all of you will find time and interest and the resources to take the opportunity to see it for yourselves. Thank you very much. And I would be delighted to take questions from the audience or comments. I'm not fussy. And there is a microphone in the middle. Christina is standing there. So if you have any questions, I'd appreciate your walking up there so we can get you on the record. And it would be appreciated if you just mention your name. Thanks.
I suppose my question is, it's been reported in the press that Robert Mugabe of Zimbabwe is gravely ill and in the hospital in Singapore. And I'm wondering about the effect of his eventual demise on Botswana and in the region generally.
Thank you. I won't speculate on his health. People have been speculating on his health and his death for a long time. But clearly, the conflict within Zimbabwe creates major problems for Botswana. First and foremost in terms of the refugees that come across and have to be taken care of, and the refugees who are not adequately taken care of in some cases and turn to crime in order to support themselves, and who are able to provide very low wage rates and be hired where Botswana, instead of Botswana within the country. So there are significant issues there. At the same time, there are cross-border issues. One of them that comes to mind is Botswana has been seeking, Botswana in the north has a border where both Zambia and Zimbabwe touch on the Botswana border. And Botswana has been trying to build a bridge at Kazangula for many years, which takes the approval of both countries. They have not been able to get the cooperation of the Mugabe government. I'm not sure you're aware of the fact that Ian Khamo was one of the, I think he was the first, and he's one of the few presidents of African countries who has criticized openly Mugabe and refused to deal with him. So, any change of government in Zimbabwe is very likely to be an asset and help Botswana in many different ways.
Hi, my name's Jason. I'd want to know about the culture of corruption there. What do you think accounts for the relative lack of corruption, whether it's a well-paid civil service, an independent judiciary, a good control over the diamond industry? I don't know if you could answer that.
I don't think that I am able to give you a specific answer. Botswana, people ask not only about the corruption, low corruption rate, but also the significant, the effective use of resources in Botswana, which differentiates it so much from other countries, for example, with oil resources that have squandered those resources. And I think that Botswana was fortunate in having Seretse Khama as its first president. He set a very high moral standard. But you can't discount the nature and traditions of the Botswana people either. Some of it, perhaps most of it, has come out of their culture, and yet it's very hard to determine why that's the case in Botswana and perhaps not the case with people from the same general tribal background just across the border. But hard to answer the question.
Yes, my name is Jeff Potter, and it's my understanding that wildlife-wise, the flooding of the Delta makes just such a massive change in being able to observe the wildlife and the growth of the wildlife and so on. Can you elaborate on that? When might be the best time of the year to get there?
Yeah, it does make a big difference, but you know, I'd have to say that I've gone all different times of the year, when there's a lot of water and when there isn't, and you get different situations arise as a result of those seasons. With a lot of water, you have the opportunity, perhaps, to see more water-borne animals. There are animals that only can be seen in the water. And yet, with less water, you see more concentrations of animals around the existing water, so it's more likely that you'll be able to see them. This past summer, for I think the third or fourth time, I went on a horseback safari in the Okavango. And for any of you who might be horseback riders, there is no better place in the world to enjoy a ride, because you are constantly going in and out of water, sometimes up to the saddle, and sometimes even beyond that. And sometimes the horses are swimming in the flooded part of the season, which is our summer, their winter. The major attraction in the Okavango, however, is not the big animals. It is the birds. And I am one who had no interest in birds when I first arrived in Botswana. But if you spend two or three days in the Okavango with a good guide and Robert's book of birds or some other bird book, you will end up both knowledgeable and fascinated by the birds of the Okavango. Please.
My name is Joe McLaughlin, and my question is about the water in the Okavango. Is the water vulnerable from political activities in Angola? I mean,
yeah.
I've heard and read that there's constant threats that people in Angola, political problems there, will end up shutting off the water.
I think that's true. Obviously, it has not happened, and there are constant efforts to prevent it, dialogues within the region. The Southern Africa Development Council, SADC, is very strong. It's a regional grouping of countries that has subgroupings based on different sectors, so that water would be one of those sectors. And there are constant discussions about allocation of resources. In the early 70s, Bechtel Engineering was brought in to do a study of the Okavango for the government of Botswana, soon after, 7 years after independence or so. And they developed plans which would bring the water of the Okavango in great volume down to the southeast. And it was a feasible program that was discussed for some period of time and then shelved, because Botswana decided that it was more important that the Okavango remain as it is so that it could be enjoyed for what it has been, a wildlife preserve. We don't know about the future in terms of Angola. It's difficult to judge, but there are close relations between the two governments. Please, sir.
Thank you for a wonderful presentation.
You're very kind.
I've been
thank
to
you.
Southern Africa about three times, and I've never been to Botswana. I've been to Zimbabwe and South Africa. Are there townships in Botswana, per se?
No. I mean, the townships were created through apartheid, really,
sure.
in South Africa.
Right.
And that no,
so they
I mean,
don't
Botswana
exist.
Was a bastion against apartheid. Those of you who are familiar with apartheid history probably know that there were significant contacts. Botswana was used by the ANC in many ways for consultation and help during that long period. So townships wouldn't exist. There are towns, there are villages.
Sure. What's the racial makeup of Botswana?
In terms of race?
Yes.
There's a very, very small population of white.
Mm-hmm. Indians, Chinese?
Yeah, there are Indians. There are some Chinese.
Mm-hmm.
And at the moment, as with most of Africa, there are large numbers of Chinese involved in construction.
Right.
The Chinese have just completed rebuilding the main airport for the country.
Okay.
There is some resentment, as happens throughout. Mm-hmm. But as I found in my visits around Africa, the Chinese are doing pretty well.
Correct. And one final question.
Please.
In traveling there, do you have to go through Johannesburg, or can you take a nonstop flight from London to?
No. As I mentioned, a major objective now is to get a nonstop flight.
Okay.
Botswana is very dependent on flights coming from Johannesburg, unfortunately. And I think they may still have flights coming from Nairobi. But in fact, Botswana needs that. They have an airport and all kinds of facilities that could deal with major flows of transportation, major air flights coming into the country, but it hasn't happened yet. It's always a chicken and egg,
sure.
Which is when there's a direct flight, a lot more people will come in, but until there are a lot of people coming in, most airlines won't start a direct flight.
Okay.
So they're working on it.
Thank you.
Thank you. And by the way, in terms of race, let me just say that Sir Seretse Khama, again, was responsible for saying, as he formed his first government, that race made no difference. And so the first couple of presidents had as their ministers and sometimes their permanent secretaries, ministers running ministries, not religious ministers, whites.
Sure.
These were sometimes people who had been born in Botswana and were white. Sometimes they were South Africans who left during apartheid to live in Botswana in the early 60s. And that's changed to a great extent. You still find some whites in government, but not at high level any longer. More in positions where they can't find someone with a specific skill.
My name's Don Hesse, and as travelers, we all find maps fascinating, and perhaps the maps of Africa more so than any other place. And if I believe when you had the map of Botswana up there, it looked like there was a small slice at the very top, perhaps with Angola or Namibia, where the border appeared to be no more than 5 or 10, the one right after that.
You are very observant.
But I just wonder what the history of that that is. And then also, I'm very curious as to whatever happened to Ruth.
Uh-huh.
A comma.
The story of Ruth, I'll deal with first. The story of Ruth was that she was a beloved leader, wife of a leader. She was very active in community programs. She was always the head of Red Cross, for example. And everyone really looked up to her. President Kama died in the, late 70s. And Ruth remained in Botswana and remained very active until her death, which occurred in the 90s. She was a friend of mine and visited us in San Francisco. President Kama had, and Ruth, had three sons, not only Ian, but twins and a daughter. And they're all still in Botswana. The Caprivi Strip is what you were asking about. And yeah, it has I'm not certain of the dates, but essentially, as I implied earlier, Africa was divided up in the late 1900s by European powers. And at that same moment, the British accepted the protectorate of Bechuanaland. And it wasn't a total, it wasn't this configuration at that time. It was slightly different. It had its borders both to the south and to the north were greater, but it was in fact divided into two territories that were later joined. And the British, during the time of the Protectorate, changed the border in the north so that there was and is today something called the Caprivi Strip, which comes across from Namibia. So you can actually find four countries, that's not quite true, but almost four countries at one point, and that's the point that I mentioned earlier where they're trying to build a bridge.
Hi, my name is Francois. I'm a student in international development. And I was wondering, you talked about the tremendous improvements in education, infrastructure, literacy rate. I was wondering what's the situation in terms of gender equality regarding education?
I think gender equality, I don't have the figures, but it's very, very high. I think that there's, in education, it's very high. And I think that there are, in fact, more women in university education than men. But there is a lot of concern that if you look at the number of women in public office, it has been on the wane. I mean, the first person I met when I was going to Botswana in 1973 was essentially the Botswana ambassador to Great Britain. The High Commissioner of Botswana at the Court of St. James, a woman. That was her most important position overseas, international position. And many of the ministers and permanent secretaries have been women over the years, but fewer today and fewer in the legislature as well. It's something that I just I saw in a speech in the legislature is a concern.
Hi, my name is Carol. Are you familiar with the Ladies' Number One Detective Agency books?
No, what's that?
Well, oh, some of us know.
Ladies' Number One Detective Agency has really put Botswana on the international
exactly.
map. All 32 volumes thereof. And I have to say that the author has done an outstanding job of capturing the Tswana culture mm-hmm. in his writings.
Well, you alluded to it before, but, you know, they describe the culture of the people as being so gentle and peace-loving. Really true?
Really true.
Ah, it's wonderful. Well, really if true. You haven't read the books, I recommend them.
Thank you for the endorsement. Well, I think that that's our last question, so I just want to say thank you to the audience. Very much enjoyed being here.
Our thanks to Honorary Consul General of the Republic of Botswana, Charles Frankel. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you.
And now our meeting at the Commonwealth Club is adjourned.